We're about ready now to get into the book of Leviticus. We'll have just a little bit more work to do in terms of setting it up by the events we read about at the end of Exodus. Okay? When we left off, we saw there were all sorts of parallels between the creation and the tabernacle, the original construction of the world in its various zones, the world, the land of Eden, the Garden of Eden, etc. We saw how those zones are duplicated in the tabernacle and how the earth, the world is described as, heavens above, earth beneath, and waters below. And how mountains come up from the earth into heaven as a meeting place with God and man. How the Garden of Eden was on a mountain and all those parallels. Okay? And we want to pick up, with that today and show how all of that leads into Leviticus. Okay? In other words, if we go back to the beginning of Genesis, man is created and he's placed in the Garden of Eden, which is on a mountain, and it's a place where God, obviously meets man. God comes to Adam and, on the Sabbath, and unfortunately, Adam has sinned. And so Adam and Eve are cast out eastward from the Garden of Eden. Sin progresses. Cain kills Abel. Cain is cast out eastward from the land of Eden. And by the time we come to chapter 6, then the whole world has been corrupted. God starts over. He covers the world back up with water, makes it all formless and void again. And then starts again with Noah on the mountains of Ararat, which I believe are the same place as, the Garden of Eden originally was. And it tells him to be fruitful and multiply. But we come just a few hundred years later, and then now man is creating his own stairway to heaven, so to speak, in the Tower of Babel. And God confounds the languages. So throughout this narrative in Genesis, we see this continual estrangement from God, a growing estrangement. And that continues on till God out of the midst of this Tower of Babel situation, he calls Abraham out. He says, I'm going to make you another nation. I'm going to give you a land. A land's going to be positioned within like the center of the world at that time. And through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. As Genesis unfolds, that family now, that from that man comes a family that when we come to the book of Exodus has become a nation. 70 people, the sons of Jacob, go down into Egypt. And of course, Jacob has a lot of servants. Abraham had 318 fighting men. Okay, so those were 20 and upward. So how many servants? Abraham's, he's extremely wealthy sheikh. Right? And then of course Isaac would have gotten, his inheritance and his servants and Jacob and so on would have gotten his. So how many actually went down to Egypt? We're not exactly sure. Just the physical descendants were 70, but they're given the whole land of Goshen. And while they're down there over the next couple hundred years, they multiply so that when Israel leaves Egypt, based on the number of men that are mustered for battle, 600 and something thousand, you have an equal number of women and you have just two kids each, you're looking at 2 to 3 million people out there in the wilderness. So this family becomes this great nation. God delivers this nation from Egypt and he brings them to Mount Sinai, and there he gives to Moses instruction for the construction of the tabernacle, which we've seen is like a new Garden of Eden, facing eastward, cherubim guarding the way, embroidered on the veil, all that sort of stuff. And so with the completion of the tabernacle at the end of the book of Exodus, It's clear there's a new stage in the history of redemption that has been reached. For the first time now, since the garden, when Moses goes up on Mount Sinai, the man is able to enter into the Lord's presence again. And so, we saw, the environs of the Mount Sinai and how they're duplicated in the tabernacle. So now they're going to take the holy mountain with them, so to speak. And so it's as if Eden has been regained. Okay? You come to the end of Exodus and, you got a place where the divine presence can dwell. Man can approach God. And, anybody would have looked at it, facing the direction it was and all of the symbolism involved. And they said, well, this is paradise restored. This is Eden regained. All right. So we really get our hopes up, except for you get right to the end of Exodus. And we're told this. Then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And then it goes on, wherever the cloud was taken up, then the children of Israel would move, etc. When it stopped, it stopped. Okay? But the point is this. We've got this new garden. We've got this new Eden. But Moses can't enter in. Moses can't enter in. And Moses was the one guy who could go up to the top of Mount Sinai. So we're still, when Exodus ends, we've got this dilemma still. We're still asking the question, Psalm 24:3, etc. Who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? How do we get back to the garden? How do we get to have a meal with God? How can we ascend the mountain? We're still left with that dilemma, even though the tabernacle is finished. Okay? That's where Leviticus comes in, Nancy. Leviticus follows immediately upon the heels of Exodus. Okay? And what the purpose it serves is to answer that question. Who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may ascend your holy hill? Well, Leviticus is going to tell us. Leviticus, it shows us how, through the priesthood, through the sacrifices, through the liturgical calendar, and so on. And so it's a book that's largely about reconciliation between God and man through that tabernacle worship. This is how it's all going to be done. All right? Now, as we know, all this is obviously pointing forward to Jesus ultimately and what he does. Okay? But it's answering that question. That's what I want us to keep in mind here. A lot of scholars have noted the tabernacle Eden imagery. And a lot of them have made parallels between the cosmos and the tabernacle. But when we come to Leviticus, many times that imagery and symbolism is then it's forgotten about. But we've got to keep that in mind, okay? That we're still, Leviticus is all about these things, this legislation that is given in conjunction with the completion of the tabernacle. It all goes together, okay? So it's going to show us how we get back in, how we go to the mountain, how we enter in the garden, how we have a meal with God. Another way to put it is this. The tabernacle is frequently referred to in two different ways in respect to the Lord. It's oftentimes referred to as a dwelling place for God. And there's two Hebrew words that just keep coming up again and again. It's a dwelling place for God. It's a place for God to dwell on earth, for a place for his Shekinah glory to appear. The other thing is it is also a tent of meeting. Okay, it's a place where God, and not just where God to dwell. You think about it, God could dwell someplace, but man could come no place near it. Right? Like, the Mount Sinai, you can't touch the base of the mountain. Could be that. but it's also a tent of meeting. All right? So when Exodus ends, it's a dwelling place of God. It's a place where heaven and earth are joined. It's like that, you know, Jacob's ladder. Jacob is at Bethel, which means Beth-El, house of God. And he sees this ladder to heaven. There's these angels ascending and descending on it. And of course, that's pointing us to Jesus. Well, that's what the tabernacle is. It's up on the mountain, so to speak. It's symbolically, they're going to carry it. The temple will be on a mountain. But it's that place where heaven and earth join together and become one. It's this dwelling place of God. But it's also going to be this tent of meeting, this place where man can ascend the mountain and go into the presence of God. When Exodus ends, it's just a dwelling place. Leviticus is going to show us how it also becomes the tent of meeting. Okay? And so I'm at Roman numeral 2, letter C, just to read this. When the tabernacle is seen as a restoration of Eden, the theology and narrative of Leviticus begins to come into focus. In particular, Leviticus demonstrates how humanity can get back inside the garden, back to the paradise of God, to again dwell in God's midst and have fellowship with Him. Okay? Where it's not, no longer just a dwelling place. We want this to become a tent of meeting as well. And Leviticus shows us how. All right? Okay. There are a lot of ways to look at Leviticus when we come to it. And I've given you a chiastic structure of the book. It shows how the Day of Atonement, the one day where the high priest gets to go behind the veil, is like at the center of the book. We'll come back to that and we'll see that again. We've seen also there are 37 speeches. I'm starting to forget now. 37 speeches, and there's 18 speeches. Then there's the Day of Atonement speech, and then there's 18 more. Yeah, it's 37, right? Okay. And there's that center speech. And noticing when the speeches begin and end, that can be really important. But just for our purposes today, looked at simply, the opening chapters, we're gonna look at 1 to 10, break it down, 1 to 7, 8 through 10. The opening chapters begin revealing the way back in through the sacrifices and the priesthood. Okay? We see that outline. And later we're going to talk about who can do those things. All right? Who can approach the tabernacle, and there's all the clean, unclean distinctions and all that sort of stuff. But if we just look at the early chapters, the first 7 chapters, you have outlined for you the major sacrifices. And I put over on the board, I put the major sacrifices there on the board. In the left-hand column, you see the traditional names of the sacrifices. We'll see this more. I've had a hard time over the years memorizing them and keeping track of them. So I'm gonna throw them out to you numerous times. And we'll see those in future notes when we go through them. But on the left-hand side, you have the traditional names of the sacrifices. And if you look at chapters 1 to 7 of Leviticus, you know, chapter 1 is all about the whole burnt offering. And then chapter 2 is the grain offering. Chapter 3 is the peace offering. And then you got the sin and trespass offerings in 5 and 6 and then there's all these laws concerning the trespass and peace offerings and so forth in chapter 6. Okay? So you got these 5 major sacrifices and the traditional names for them. In the right-hand column, I have some names that I think are better names. Okay? We got the names we're kind of stuck with because that's what the translators chose to do. But there's better ways to think of these sacrifices that will explain them a lot better. Okay? It's like, for example, a whole burnt offering. It's called that because the whole animal is burnt up. But literally, in Hebrew, it's the ascension offering. It's going up. Now, the main thing is that animal's being turned into smoke and it's ascending. All right? The second offering we call the grain offering, because it's the one that is not an animal sacrifice. Okay, it's the work of your hands, it's the produce of the field. But that the word there is the word more for tribute or gift. So imagine you're going up to a king and you've been invited to his house, so you're bringing a gift to him. Okay. The third offering, that we can keep that one, okay? Peace offering. That's a good name, okay? The peace offering is the only one that's really a sacrifice. The other ones are offerings. And it's the one where the worshiper gets to eat a meal with God. There's a sense in which these first three all go together. And they're all covered in one speech. If you look at Leviticus 1, now the Lord called to Moses. Okay, now he addresses him. And this just goes on until chapter 4, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying. So 1 to 3 is all one big speech. So we're going to see these sacrifices are part of a sequence. The worshiper is going to go up, it's going to ascend through the substitute, through the animal, with a gift. And it's going to have a meal with God. See, because that's what it's about, right? You got to go up the mountain. We want to get back in the garden. And we want to eat of the tree of life. Right? I mean, those trees there in the garden are sacrificial trees. Okay? So you have those three. And then the other, the sin offering, which you find in chapter 4, better referred to as the purification offering. The thing about the sin offering is it has all to do with or what we'll call the purification offering. And again, I'll come back to these many times until we get all these in our head. It has to do with the manipulation of the blood. Okay? Blood, blood's going to be placed on the four horns of the altar out there. Or blood's going to be, you know, in other cases, it's going to be splashed on the side. But God's got to see the blood. It's like the Passover. Okay? And then finally, the trespass offering, we'll call the guilt or maybe the reparation offering. I say I haven't decided yet. I'm not even going to try to that's the offering that has to be offered in order to de-sanctify you if you've become holy when you shouldn't have been. Okay? We'll explain that later. But notice there are all these sacrifices, and they have a geography to them. Okay? And they're gonna be in order. Later on in chapter 9, when the tabernacle is actually put into place and things are worked out for the first time, there's going to be a purification offering, which makes atonement. And blood's going to be put out there on the altar, and God's going to see that altar, so his wrath will be appeased. Then you can have those first three. Then God's got to see the blood. Atonement has to be made. The sanctuary has to be cleansed. Then the worshiper can ascend and present gifts to God and then have a meal with God. Okay? So there's a sequence. And again, we'll go over this a lot more later. But that's what we mean by that. And that sequence then, so all these sacrifices that are laid out in the first seven chapters, that's all going to be performed by the priesthood that we learn about in chapters 8 through 10. He's the one that's going to be performing these rituals. Okay? On behalf of the people. Any questions or comments right there? We have purification offering at the beginning after we're called. God calls Moses, he calls us. We wouldn't come unless he called. And that's the name of Leviticus in the Hebrew Bible, and he called. The New Testament, we definitely will.
Right, so here this corresponds to confession of sin. Whoops, no, that's the problem. See, I got the order. This is our confession. This is like the social portal. And the sermon, etc., the ascending and hearing the law, all that. This is our tithes and offerings. This is the supper. Okay? And then there's going to be a commission. Trespass offering is less frequent for, I guess, that other thing.
Okay, we're going to see this is duplicated in our worship. But we'll get into that. We'll spend plenty of time there later. Okay. I just want you, yes, sir.
I get a little confused with what's metaphorical and what's not. And of course, I think many times they're the same. There's no distinction. But when we talk about getting back to the garden, as you keep laying out as the recurring pattern, really, it's not literally getting back to the garden, it's getting back to the presence of God. Is that accurate?
Getting back to the garden, because that's the place where God meets man. It's more about getting back to the presence of God, because the garden is going to be transfigured into a city that's eventually going to cover the whole earth, right? So I guess you can see that, because the goal is for heaven and earth as a whole to be joined. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So. I don't know how to answer that, say yes and no. It really is about entering into God's presence. You're right, you know, say it that way. And then God's presence filling the whole earth.
Because it can end up being the future as well, right? Mm-hmm. What's the existing pattern and where are we going with this? And of course, the original would have been, well, I guess after the fall, but the first instance of the pattern would have been where it's going ultimately.
Getting back on track as what was originally intended, maybe?
Yeah. That would put it that way.
Because, I think you've taught us before that the intention was never that we were always going to be in a garden, that there was going to be a progression to a city.
Exactly. And Adam and Eve, there's the thing. They would be fruitful and multiply. They would have children. They would go downstream, you know, obviously, and subdue the earth for the glory of God. So yeah, the goal is to transform the garden into a city that covers the whole earth. Okay? But at this time in redemptive history, we're going to see, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. We're going to see that before the tabernacle, people offer sacrifices. Noah offers sacrifices. Abraham offers sacrifices. And they'll usually do it on high places or at like garden oasis places. Okay? Once the tabernacle was built, though, you can no longer do that. Once the tabernacle was built, there is only one place that you can offer sacrifice. Once the temple takes the place of the tabernacle, that's the only place sacrifice can be altered. And I should note, Abraham and so forth, by the way, when this purification operates, a lot of times in the Bible, I'll just mention the New Testament, the word that the Greek New Testament, the Greek Old Testament uses for the sin offering is, how do I say this? Sometimes when it talks about Jesus, like he who knew no sin became sin for us. It's literally he became a sin offering for us. He became a purification offering for us. It's not just he became sin. He became a sin offering for us. Okay? Yeah.
So at Jesus' death on the cross and the curtain was torn, then no longer, it was things were changing as it did between the mountain and the temple.
That's why Jesus is crucified. The cross becomes the stairway to heaven.
Yeah.
The cross becomes the meeting place. Jesus, I think all the evidence, he was crucified on the Mount of Olives, which is the one mountain higher than the Temple Mount, Mount Moriah. I think all the evidence is there that that's where he was crucified. So that becomes the new place. The new Jesus is, you know, he's the stairway to heaven. He's Jacob's ladder, and he's the place where heaven and earth intersect. After that, Ken.
So as far as these, like, the different offerings, and so you mentioned that Noah, you know, like he or not Noah, Joe would make the sacrifices for his kids in case they sin. So those were basically offerings of just kind of like holding back God's wrath, but you still couldn't enter into God's presence yet. And so you did
Yeah, it's a new stage in the history of redemption, and with it comes greater privileges, but also greater responsibilities. And there's a principle throughout Scripture that the nearer you are to God, the greater the degree of holiness, and the greater degree of punishment. Which is why, like I said, Adam got death penalty for eating a piece of fruit. Okay? Uzzah touches the ark, God kills him. We're going to see no sooner than these priests are ordained. Chapter 10, Aaron's going to lose two sons. Because when there's a closer presence here than was before. Greater privileges, greater responsibilities are all going to be tied up with you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay. Brian, did you have? Well, just putting the cobble,
that's just a cross. So it doesn't correspond with a sacrifice. So we'll put that here. Okay.
All right. Let me down here at the bottom of the page, that first page. Let me point out a few things. Our title Leviticus we get from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. But in Hebrew, the book of Leviticus comes from its opening words, "And he called." Okay? We don't realize it. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy all begin with the word "and." Okay? They're connected to Genesis because the first five books, the Torah, the Pentateuch are you know, kind of one seamless garment. I mean, there are clearly those distinct places and so forth, but they're intended to go together. And our Bibles usually don't. We don't like to start with "and." Seem like there's some famous piece of literature that starts. What is that? Some "and"? I don't remember. Anyway, we usually translate that "now." Now the Lord called Moses, but it's "and he called." And that phrase, the phrase that is used here, is a phrase that God uses throughout the Pentateuch to draw man in his to his presence. You see it in "God called to Adam in the garden." And then the next time, you know, God calls to Moses from the mountain to come up. And God called to Moses from within the cloud. And Yahweh called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. So you have this, we're turning over to the next page. With the descent of the divine presence to the tabernacle and this call to man, we're seeing that God is again dwelling with humanity. But again, Exodus ends and he can't approach. All right, he can't draw near, and it's really kind of shocking if you think about it, because Moses at Mount Sinai had been allowed into the divine presence on the mountaintop, where the theophany occurred, the manifestation of God, and he takes his feet, you know, his shoes off because it's holy ground. So, you know, when Exodus concludes, we're kind of shocked. If Moses can't go inside, well, what are we going to do? You know, what's going to happen? Well, Leviticus is there to answer that question. If we think about, we'll get to where we can. If we think about these parallels there between the creation and the tabernacle, how the creation of the tabernacle harkened back to the creation of the world, they both conclude, you know, seven speeches, 7 days with the Sabbath, etc. We can see the reason why man can't get back into the garden is because we don't have a new Adam yet. We're going to see later on in Hebrews, with the changing of the priesthood comes the changing of the law. Prior to this time, it's as if Moses is the priest, all right? But with the construction of the tabernacle now, we need a new priesthood. And of course, author of Hebrews talks about there's a priesthood that supersedes the Aaronic priesthood, the priesthood after the order of Melchizedek, which is superior, which is doesn't have a beginning, doesn't have an end. And so the Aaronic priesthood is going to be a temporary priesthood. But nevertheless, with the construction of the tabernacle now, Moses is going to be out of a job. And now it's going to be Aaron's job. And Aaron's going to be like a new Adam for this new creation. Okay? And so what we have in those early chapters of Leviticus, you have okay. Remember, we got the cherubim there, and the cherubim's got the flaming sword. So to get to God, we got to come through fire and knife. We got to be cut up. We got to be burned up. We got to ascend in the smoke. So we have the set out for us. We have the sacrifices. We have the priesthood is ordained, and it's not till chapter 9 that everything is operational. Okay? The priestly ministry begins in chapter 9. And in this inaugural ceremony, priesthood is established, tabernacle is consecrated, And you have those sacrifices again. The purification offering first, then ascension, tribute, and peace offering. Okay? That's the order. Okay? And so we have this idea of drawing near then. For the first time, I said, let her see here that God now begins to speak directly to Aaron. All right? So with chapter 9, it's like that tension at the end of Exodus is resolved. You might even say the tension that's been since Genesis 3 is resolved. For the first time, now, you know, man is able to approach the divine presence. There's a sense, of course, before it, Moses did on Sinai. Now there's a new priesthood, though, that's going to do it. Just to kind of finish on, we should point out that when Moses went into the divine presence on Mount Sinai, and when Aaron goes into, for example, the most holy place, etc., it is on behalf of the people. Okay? The priest isn't doing it just for himself. He's doing it on behalf of the people. Back in Exodus 20:19, it says, then they said to Moses, you speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die. Okay? Because the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightnings, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking, etc. And they saw it, they trembled and stood afar. So they said, you go in that presence for us. Okay? You speak with them because we're too scared. In the same way, in Leviticus 9, it becomes very clear that the priest is doing this on behalf of the people. Then Aaron lifted his hand toward the people, blessed them, and came down from offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, the peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle meeting, came out and blessed the people. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offerings and the fat on the altar. When all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Okay, so once this tabernacle is inaugurated, Moses loses his job. Aaron is our new Adam, and the worship service culminates with a blessing on the people and a manifestation of God's presence for the people to see by the fire out on the altar. Okay, the fire out on the altar, which God Himself lights, is like a representation of that pillar of fire by night and cloud by day that is inside the most holy place. Okay? It's a manifestation for the people to see. And let me just read this letter E. It says, in the lighting of the fire on the altar, there's a sense in which the goal of creation is consummated, and that the divine fire on the altar served as a continual meeting place for God and Israel. And that's what it's called. It's a meeting place. That altar is the meeting place. That's where the animal goes to be burned up to ascend into God's presence. However, Leviticus makes it clear that God must be approached through sacrifice and an ordained priesthood to offer them. It is only through the divinely revealed legislation found in Leviticus that the fire that dwells in their midst does not consume the nation. See, this becomes the place of the burning bush, so to speak. Alright. There is a pattern. Now just to look forward, I'm going to turn this over to Seth here. Going to lead us in a couple chants. There's a pattern in scripture. You conquer the enemy. You take the spoils. You build the house. God sits down in throne. He lights the altar. Okay? Think about it. Children of Israel are slaves in Egypt. They leave, they go out in the wilderness, and they're able to make this golden calf. Where did they get all the gold? Well, the Egyptians just said, leave. Here, take this stuff. Go, get out. After all those plagues, they wanted them to go. The gods of Egypt laid low. God had destroyed them. So they go out into the wilderness. They take all these spoils. They build the tabernacle. God sits down in throne. He lights the fire on the altar. Later on, David, what does he do? He goes out and he conquers all Israel's enemies round about. Once he does that, they have peace. Solomon builds the temple. The glory cloud takes up residence in there. God lights the fire on the altar. What does Jesus do? He comes, he binds the strong man, he conquers the enemy so that his goods can be spoiled. What does he do? He says, go make disciples of the nations. Spoil the enemies. Now the spoils are people. Isaiah 53 says, he will see the travail of his soul and be satisfied. He will justify many and he will divide the spoil with the strong. Okay? What's this notion that this amillennial notion that Jesus is going to have the small portion? He's going to divide the spoil with the strong. He's going to see the travail of his soul and be satisfied. Now it's people. So Jesus conquers the enemy. He said, go out now, spoil the enemy. What does he do? He goes to heaven. He sits down on his throne. And on the day of Pentecost, sends down fire. Fire that doesn't consume. A fire that just purifies us. Holy Spirit comes down upon us because now we're the temple of God. Right?